impedance is determined usually by the ratio of the voltage and the current at the feed point, and it's simply calculated from the Ohm's law. But anyhow, another thing is, Dr. Roy, I sent you the email with 8 points of the science section, so you have it in case you need to look at them or put them on your webpage. And talk to you.
Okay, and I thank you for that, Wes. Wesley, I wish you would kind of send it to me a wee bit earlier when I had time to read it. I very much would like to have the ability of talk, think, listen, and read simultaneously, but I don't think I'm quite up to all those things at the same exact time.
I would try to do it before that, but I disagree with your comment. For me, you are brilliant. I'm not trying to compliment you. And you have some incredible ability to very fast, very precise and concise comments and questions.
Well, thank you very much, Wesley, but, you know, don't do this too much or it'll swell my head and I won't be able to get through the door of the shack. If anyone's interested what my little work area, what my shack might look like, especially when I'm doing these technical nets, because I remember there was a big question about whether Dick, came to do the tech net in his pajamas and slippers, or whether he wore something else. So you could go to QRZ and just look me up, and there's a couple of nice pictures of the shack and what I lovingly call Command Central, which is a three-monitor computer setup with a whole bunch of stuff. Like I'm following Echolink, I'm following the chat room, I'm following mail, and I'm following IRLP as well. Anyway, once again, if anyone has any radio technology questions, because we like to get them done before we move on to science and technology in general, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, we hereby open the door to any science questions. If you have any questions or any topics or comments you want to make, if you want to talk about anything, chemistry, physics, medicine, if you want to discuss COVID-19, in the last few months, people really don't want to do that anymore on the technical net. Last year, in doing the science talk, I always included a update as it barreled across China and such. But it's an open subject, along with everything else. If anyone has any questions, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Relating to the vaccine, you see the vaccine has a chemical in it, I think they call it an ethylene. It's like a glycol. Apparently it's some kind of able to act as an antifreeze. Some people apparently are allergic to it, and then they have to be treated for it. Very few people, but you know, that brought to mind this antifreeze that they have in it, and they're running at it minus 95 degrees Fahrenheit, I think minus 70 degrees centigrade. But you know, they have it at this very cold temperature. This tells me that maybe this stuff, fluid, this vaccine isn't actually frozen. Maybe it's still like in a liquid form, but it's being kept at a low temperature. Do you think that's what's going on? Back to you, Roy.
I don't know for sure. What I would think is that this is more of a case where they don't want ice crystals to form. And it may still allow it to solidify, but not with large ice crystals, which might cause deterioration of the messenger RNA.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we just I was wondering about that, and also the new virus that they found in England. I heard a couple of doctors on TV, watched CNN. They think that it's probably likely that the vaccines will be able to work against that new virus as well. I wonder if you read anything about that. I hope it does. Back to you.
Yeah, it's my understanding that it has not changed in that the vaccines have no different effect. All that it seems to do is, because we've kind of we talked about this in the past, that viruses and most objects that have genes, genetic sequences, they drift over time. The quicker they reproduce and, you know, their life cycle, the shorter their life cycle, the more likely there'll be more and more variation in their DNA, or in the case of COVID, their RNA. It's been drifting from the very beginning back in China. The variants in the United Kingdom apparently demonstrate a heightened infectability. So whereas, you know, if you had some infected person in a room and 50% of the people became infected, with this new variation, 60 or 65% will become infected. But according to everything I've read so far, there's no indication that the immunological aspects of this variation are different. The vaccine should be just as effective for it as for older variations of this virus.
Sounds good. Very good. Hope that all works. I'll be happy when the vaccines show up.
Yes, I hope so as well. Well, you know, we have the Pfizer, and that's in the pipeline, and people are slowly getting it. We will start getting the Moderna. They approved that this week, so that's going to be in the pipeline. That benefits, we talked a little bit a week or two ago, that because there is a lipid layer surrounding it, it's a little bit less sensitive to temperature, and so it can be kept in a regular freezer much longer than the Pfizer version. So that'll be another pipeline for vaccines, and they're more amenable to smaller communities that don't have very low temperature refrigerators. And as time goes on, hopefully there will be additional vaccines that have been found to be viable and safe. So if we can just grit our teeth and keep our masks on and socially distance for the winter, I think we'll reach the end of this damn tunnel.
I heard Johnson & Johnson is coming out soon as well, so that'll be three.
Yeah, I mean, there are 100 different trials going on out there. As a matter of fact, I always set up a little science talk list of articles, and there's a couple of articles on vaccines that didn't quite make it. There was one in Australia that for some odd reason they decided to take small bits from the HIV virus, not the infectious type, in order to get it into the immune system and cause a reaction. It might be somewhat beneficial, but the side effect is that anyone who takes that vaccine tests positive for HIV. They don't have an active HIV infection, but it confuses the test for HIV. So they basically just shut that one down.
Very good. Yeah, it sounds like we got the good ones here in the States. I wonder, you know, either Moderna or Pfizer, you know, such a small amount that goes through that needle into somebody's arm. Apparently it's supposed to be some kind of protein or some chemical, whatever it is. But that must have the capability of reproducing itself to go from, like, one RNA cell to another body. So it must have a reproducing capability that we get. You know what the story is on that, Roy?
Yes, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are a new technology. Before them, we had no actual vaccine using this technology that had gone into production and really benefited anyone. It was more of a research project. The concept is that you take aspects of the COVID-19 virus, primarily things like the protein spike that duplicates the certain receptors on epithelial layers of cells and tells the epithelial cells that it's a friendly little package and it should bring it into the cell insides and then it infects it. So they take the gene sequence, because China was able to, almost at the beginning, sequence its RNA completely. So you find those RNA sequences, you then transcode them to something very closely related called messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is the means by which most living cells transfer information from the nucleus into other parts of the cell that manufacture proteins. So this strand of messenger RNA goes from the nucleus to different organelles in the cell, and they pump out, in this case, the spike protein. So we're doing sort of the same thing. We're pumping in messenger RNA in that injection. It gets absorbed into the cells. The cell gets confused. Since it's messenger RNA, it will transcribe it into proteins. It produces a whole bunch of spike proteins, which then leak out of the cell or bust the cell, and those get picked up by our own immune system, which realizes it's an invader, it's a foreign protein, and then makes up antibodies and the other cascades, killer cells and such, that fight infection. So that's the principle behind messenger RNA. There are other types of vaccines, some that use adenoviruses as carriers of the proteins, and other technologies being tried. But these two are messenger RNA vaccines.
Question in one wide away.
Yes, thanks.
Isn't there some type of issue with keeping mRNA alive long enough to enter the cell wall, pass through the cell wall, and enter the cytoplasm of the cell?
Well, yeah, but thankfully they've figured out ways of making it relatively easy for it to pass on. I don't know what technologies they've implemented. In the case of the Moderna, they use a lipid bilayer, which is the same material that cell membranes are made out of. There are other techniques. But yeah, if you can't get it into the cell, it's meaningless and it doesn't work. So what's very important is somehow figuring a way of getting these little collections of messenger RNA into human cells so that they'll reach the area in the cytoplasm where protein transcription occurs. Without the protein transcription, you don't have the protein spikes, and you have nothing for the immune system to recognize.
Okay, thank you. N1 Whitey White Clear.
I want one more question. All right, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Okay, so from what you're saying, this vaccine gets injected into you. It only goes into one small area in your body and changes, or it gets into your cells, and then eventually that creates some kind of protein that eventually works its way out. So it's only that little bit, and then your immune system recognizes that little bit and then adjusts if you actually get the virus, it'll go after that virus. It's not like this RNA, this drug is changing all the cells in your whole body to going from cells, trillions of cells not doing that. It's only doing a little bit in that one area in your arm. That's what you're saying. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I think you're alluding to something called a retrovirus, in which retroviruses act, among other things, by taking a piece of DNA that they have, or the RNA that they have, transcoding it into DNA and sticking it into the very nucleus. Herpes virus tends to work like that, where you can have you can have herpes kind of sit quietly for 50 years and then all of a sudden bust out. This has no effect on your DNA whatsoever. It's not even proper RNA. It's a messenger RNA. It only really attaches itself to the mechanisms that turn messenger RNA into templates into protein structures. So the nucleus of people who are treated is completely unchanged.
Okay, so it's only localized. They inject you, goes into some, you know, wherever it gets injected to, and that's really as far as it's going to go. You know, it's not going to spread throughout your whole body. That little bit, that's why you only need that little bit, and it's not going to duplicate itself. It's just going to release, I think you said, a protein, and then the system will recognize that. And that's it. I mean, it's possible to remove the same amount of vaccine that you just put into your body. It wouldn't matter. Once your body understands that, you know, if this particular thing shows up again, your immune system will go after that. It's like its job is done probably soon after it's injected. Well, I know you have to go back for a second injection, but pretty much done after that. Isn't that about the way it works, Roy? WS.
Yeah, basically what happens is it's not an intravenous injection. If it was intravenous, it would get into your veins and then through your entire blood supply and be spread and diluted all over your body. These are just subcutaneous intramuscular injections, local injections. The messenger RNA is slowly absorbed by the local cells. They manufacture a lot of spike proteins. The spike proteins leak out into the outside of the cell, where they're either picked up through the venous system or the lymphatic systems, which drain into the venous systems, and they eventually land in your lymph nodes, where antibodies are manufactured and killer leukocytes are formed that recognize that particular protein. And that's why you need a booster shot, because after a while, your body kind of clears all of those foreign proteins. So they felt that a second booster would cause a much better immune status than if it was a one-shot deal.
Very good. All right. Thanks for all of that, Roy. Well, I got one more word to say, and that's just amazing. This whole system that they developed. Very good.
You got to hand it to these guys. They basically did something that has never been done before. If you go down and you look at how long it took in the past to develop a vaccination protocol for a terrible disease, the best case that I've ever heard, I think, is either measles or mumps, in which it only took them 4 years from the beginning of trying to find something to finding something that's effective. So, and if you think about it, they just started this about February or March. So it's sort of amazing, the incredible the short time that it took. So, you know, I mean, these guys should be given Nobel Prizes, a hand, you know, a free of taxes for the rest of their lives, if I had anything to do with it. They really came through for us.
I concur. Very good. I'll let you go on. Whatever.
Okay, very good. Once again, anyone out there with any technical questions, Bill, if you just thought up one. But if not, any science questions or topics, or if you want to talk or ask something about COVID-19, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Rocco, KD2UAH.
Yes, Rocco.
Roy, my question is, you talked about viral load before in relation to HIV. And I'm wondering why we don't talk as much about viral load in regards to COVID. I'm a dentist. I've had people in increasing quantities that pass all the little screening tests we give them, totally non-symptomatic, and then a day or two we found out that they had COVID, completely non-symptomatic, and it seems like the number of younger people, two high school students, that we had are rising. Could it be that their lower viral load makes them non-symptomatic?
It's possible, but there's been very little study. I think part of that is simply that doing viral load tests up until recently, I don't know if there have been any major breakthroughs, is very problematic. There's a lot of false positives, a lot of false negatives, and so that kind of gets in the way. And unfortunately, I think we're going to get a lot of information about viral loads with 2020 hindsight, you know, in the future, as opposed to presently. It's possible that viral loads is a factor in young people, although it may equally be that their immunological processes are better in dealing with it than people beyond a certain age. There's a lot of inflammatory process cascading that goes on with people, you know, 40, 50, and it gets worse at 60 and 70, and that might be an aspect. That's still up in the air, and I'm sure people are going to be writing all kinds of papers about this for years to come.
Okay, thank you. Right back to you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else with any questions or comments tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, a couple things. Just an addition. I heard that Johnson & Johnson is just, like you say, it is a one-shot deal. So I guess that has some advantages if it's as effective as the others. And just a general comment, and you know, you reflect on this. I guess there's some advantage to people who are not in the front of the line. By the time it comes to us, in a couple months or more, there'll be more knowledge about which of the vaccines is better, and maybe we have a choice of which one, or maybe we won't, because they might just be like, your area only has this one. But just a general idea of reflection on that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a case of probabilities. If you can keep yourself socially distant and at relatively low risk, you could play for time, and to a degree that will offer you more information. Is there any particular vaccine that's either more effective or more effective longer or has less side effects? At this point, it seems like the Moderna vaccine has a little bit higher of a side effect protocol than the Pfizer. Whether that's significant or not remains to be seen. But, you know, as they roll them out, everyone will get a better idea. It may come to a point where you have the option of choosing which, at the near the tail end, my guess would be you would get the choice. But in the middle, you'll probably just get offered the only thing that's available in our area.
Right, and also, like, it turns out, of course, that the Johnson & Johnson isn't as safe and effective as the other two. You know, being only one shot, certainly is it better. It's probably cheaper and easier logistically to administer. What about tracking people down and getting them back in 3 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess that they might start experiencing the benefits faster, though I don't know that to be the case. Back to you, Roy, KD2NVB.
well, ultimately, in the short run, and when I say short run, I mean about 6 months' time, the problems are going to be the supply chain. Thankfully, they all use somewhat different supplies, so they don't compete directly too much with each other. So it'll be a matter of how many they can produce. They won't be able to produce as many vials as everyone will want, because if you think about it, you know, you got to vaccinate a good portion of the population of the world. That's a lot of vials. And these manufacturing facilities are limited places. So although a single shot is, to me, much preferred over a double shot, because the compliance will be dramatically different, I fear. So when you have a one-shot deal, your compliance zooms up. And they're not quite sure what happens if you're non-compliant, if you only take the first and not the booster. There are some optimistic reports that you get a significant amount of immunity even if you miss the second shot, but I would prefer people not do things like that. So it'll be more of a supply chain limitation that develops. I think people are still going to get all the vaccines as long as they're efficacious and safe. All of them are going to be used simply because the supply chain is limited.
Right, but I guess definitely. But the one shots, which you only have to make half as many vials for each person, which would certainly be an advantage, probably both financially and logistically, and just to get more out there to more people quicker. And yeah, of course, these are all kind of obvious points, I guess. And the I was going to say something else, I'm just blanking. So I can't imagine there'd be too many people who get the first shot of the two-shot variety and then not go for the second, unless, of course, they get a bunch of side effects, and then I can see people going, I ain't doing that again. I even heard somebody say that they thought the booster might give more side effects than the initial shot. I think they're talking about Pfizer, but I'm not sure. Back to you, KD2MBV.
Well, you're sort of making the assumption that all human beings are rational creatures, and having practiced medicine for many years, that doesn't seem to be very self-evident sometimes. So there will be people who fastidiously take their second booster on the day that they're supposed to. There are guys who will take it much later, and I'm sure some guys at the back of the bar who will tell anyone who listens to them how they never took anything. Or whatever. So people are kind of flaky that way. So I would love them not to be, but they will. There's already antivirus, you know, conspiracies cropping up on Facebook and such. So it's going to get worse before it gets better. That's the nature of humanity.
Yeah, I guess I should know from recent times that people are not. Or many people, anyway, are not rational. All right, carry on. Back to you, who I think.
Thank you, Bob. Anyone else with any science-related, technology-related questions? Give me your first name and your call sign.
Mike, KD2BDW.
Yes, Mike.
One of the things that I found interesting in all of this was, and I can't find the article, I mean, I could research it for sure, was a professor who goes around the world studying animals and diseases basically predicted this. He said that the way we are, basically, I mean, this won't be the last. It's basically, his view is very simple. I mean, China wanted to create a road to get from point A to point B that never had a road before. So our cringe, you know, like even Connecticut, for example, they said they built more houses. And the more houses, you know, one species away and then the other one didn't have a predator. So basically it was interesting for me to hear how our advancement, our big cities, our buildings basically put us more in touch with animals and change the whole ecological system that kind of sparks these viruses. I wonder what your take is on that.
Well, I mean, I agree with that concept. That concept's been going on for thousands of years. Civilizations that did not have significant agriculture did not come into contact with animals as much as civilizations that did. One of the many reasons that when people from the old world came to the new world, they spread all kinds of animal-borne infections among the population and basically killed a great number of indigenous people. So this has always been a case. The mutation of virus and bacteria is a never-ending cat-and-mouse game. We develop immunological methods to get around them, to fight them, fight off infections. Infectious organisms develop ways of getting around them, and it goes on and on and on. And by adding a close contact with different types of animals who harbor different groups of viruses and bacteria, we increase the risk. And now, because we are a global connected society and one person can go around the globe in a matter of days, before we even know there's something to spread, it spreads. So people have sort of been talking about this for at least 20 years. Bill Gates, was talking a lot about pandemics and even about corona-like viruses. There have been a few pandemics before based on coronaviruses. This has been the largest and the worst. And it's not going to stop. So thankfully, we've built up more armament in fast turnaround vaccines than we used to have. But this is a never-ending battle between life and whatever viruses are. Some people call it life. Some people call it not quite life.
And it's interesting to see the comparison to the 1812, to now. Some of it's so exactly the same. And it's kind of funny because when we think of viruses, as you said, misinformation goes as quick as information nowadays. So many people are, I've heard recently somebody say that, that virus, it can only be out of the refrigerator for 3 hours. So how do you know if you get the Pfizer and it didn't go bad already? So, we all need to be careful because this information spreads as easily as good information.
Thankfully, we're living in a kind of a golden age of technology. And again, a vaccine for a virus in less than a year is amazing. And there were a lot of people who weren't quite sure we could pull something like that off. But human nature, unfortunately, if it changes very, very, very slow. So I have a book on the great pandemic of 1918. People did the same foolish things then that they do now. They didn't have Facebook to blame it on, but they found other ways of doing foolish things. And again, that's just the way we're designed. It would be nice if we could come up with a cure for that as well.
Amen to that. Yep. And we'll get through this and we'll learn. Hopefully we'll come out smarter and better. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Mike. I hope so. Wisdom is unfortunately not just related to age. It's what you do with the years that you're alive. If you learn by your mistakes and you learn by others' mistakes, hopefully you become wise as you become older. But there are too many people who don't seem to learn from either their mistakes or others, and they just get older. They don't get wiser. But let's hope that we all get wiser as we get older. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limemark Technical Net. If you have any other questions of a scientific, technical, or medically related basis, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2TRG.
Yes, Robert.
Who
we're all talking about this, and I'm 63 years old, and I remember when I was a kid, the amount of vaccinations I got were, what, three, I think, something like that, four. You got MMR, and that was pretty much so it. And then when I went into the military, you know, we got all kinds of boosters, and they just jacked us up with all kinds of stuff. And now I look at this stuff like with my kids are 35 and 34, and now I've recently become a grandpa, and I was talking to my daughter about the amount of vaccinations that my grandson has to get is absolutely amazing, and I'm just wondering what kind of rabbit hole we're going down with all these vaccines. I mean, I'm not one of these anti-vaccine people, trust me, but it's just, you know, where does it end? When do we have to stop getting all these vaccinations? Is it because of the small world we're living in, how much close we're getting together, and the probability and the easiness to pass things? But when does it end? KD2TRG.
Well, I think it's more related to the fact that in when you were and I were a child, and I'm sure you had a tetanus shot and a diphtheria shot and a pertussis shot and a polio vaccine, because I had all those, and I'm only 2 years older than you. But as we come up with vaccinations for more diseases that a lot of people get anyway, everyone kind of thinks, the health agencies, that it's better to vaccinate against it than deal with the repercussions. I mean, when I was a kid, there were no vaccines for chickenpox, and so I got stuck with having chickenpox. I would have liked to have gotten a vaccine against it, but none were available.
It's funny you picked that, because I remember when my older sister had it, my mother was telling me to make sure I hung around my sister so I could get it and get over and be done with it. And I think we did something very similar to the mumps. Once it got in the house, my parents wanted to make sure that all of us got it so we'd be done with it. It was one of those things.
Yeah, back then it was very common to have chickenpox parties. If one kid in the neighborhood had chickenpox, they arranged for a little get together where all of them would get it and get it out of their system. Because as you get older, the risk of complications, lung damage, neurological damage, and other organ problems kind of increases. You don't want people to get chickenpox when they're 40 or 50 or 60. You don't now. They figured that with vaccines, they don't have to get them at all. And in addition, they are suggesting giving vaccines so that you don't wake up with herpes zoster. I've treated more than a few people wandering to the office and don't know what the hell those blisters are, and they can be very, very painful, uncomfortable, and scarring. So you know, if a vaccine can obviate that, I think that's a good deal, personally.
Yeah, Roger. It's like the you know, everybody was talking about the mutations of different viruses and stuff, and it's I guess that is like a precursor to shingles when that comes out in people. Correct?
Yeah, shingles is just the term given for a recurrent chickenpox virus. The virus will kind of sit there quietly and not cause you any problems until years and years and years later, and some kind of stress to the body reactivates those quiescent viral particles, and they run down the nerve ends that they've been sleeping in, and blossom as blisters on some part of your anatomy.
Yeah, Roger that. One of my Navy friends actually recently I think he said he was getting a booster shot or something to make sure he didn't get shingles, and he ended up having other complications from it. It was a bizarre case, and I think it was just the physiology of his own body that caused the complications he had. But he ended up with edema, had heart problems, lung problems, was in the hospital. They didn't know what the hell was wrong with him,
until they finally figured out that it was the shingles shot that he got. So he got a shot so he wouldn't get shingles, and he ended up in the hospital for 3.5 weeks with heart and lung problems from it.
Well, like most things, nothing is 100% safe. And ultimately, you need luck for almost anything and everything. You know, the risks are small in the general population, but for a few people, they're large. You know, different people have different ways of wrapping their head around it. You know, there were some people who looked at the mortality rate for COVID-19 is somewhere between 1 or 2%. So their attitude apparently was to kind of flip it and say, well, 98, 99% of the people live. So why are we doing any of this nonsense? So it's interesting how human beings deal with numbers.
Roger that. I guess that's just one of those things that anybody can justify anything they want in their own mind, if I'm not mistaken. AC2GS, this is KD2TRG. Thanks again, Roy. I'll talk to you later.
You're very welcome, Robert. Thank you for participating. Wesley, you want to do your thing?
Definitely. Can you look at email to point number one? Over there. Let me know that you're on the same page.
Again, I have your email open. I couldn't actually read the articles while I was talking, so I haven't read any of the articles. All I have are the topics and the links.
Yeah, it helps, I mean, in case you need reference. Okay, so point number one, the Thai researchers studying how chicken feathers can be beefed up menus. So we have Sorod Kitty Banhorn, a scientist from Bangkok, and he thinks chicken feathers could be turned up into the lean protein rich source of edible food. So he made the prototypes, including his form of chicken nuggets, which were not chicken nuggets, and a steak substitute, and has received positive reviews from, well, whoever he did. He was doing masters in materials features in London, and he had an idea that 2.3 million tons of feathers are being dumped in Europe, and in Asia probably 30% more. So that was there was a good thought. In Kesesart University, India, a food scientist professor was pleasantly surprised with the results. And the problem is that for vegetarians, plant-based substitutes for meat have been gaining popularity as more people shift towards vegetarian or vegan diets amid growing concerns about health risks from eating meat, animal welfare, and environmental hazards of intensive animal farming. So it turns out that since the feather is... let me drop. The feather-based food could not be recognized as vegan or vegetarian because they come from feathers, so that is part of the animal's world. But a few restaurants who operate at zero waste form restaurant, right, are interested because they could have dishes made from poultry waste, and it is still a byproduct from the animal we normally consume. What do you think, Dr. Roy, about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly is a good idea to use stuff that you would throw away. It decreases carbon footprints and such.
I don't know if I would particularly like to avail myself of it. I could easily see, you know, future articles on things like YouTube where these fast food joints are just grinding up everything, liquefying it, splashing a little bit of normal color and calling it all kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, in the case of dwindling resources and increasing populations, any kind of method to squeeze, you know, foodstuffs out of what we already have is a good idea.
Thank you very much. Point number two. India to build solar wind energy farms along the border with Pakistan. If I remember correctly, it was Gujarat, a province next to the Pakistan. So India wants to build wind energy farms along the border with Pakistan. Work on the project would be roughly 18 months after approval from the Defense Ministry of, following the land feasibility studies. But that was through a report from 2019. Now, they're doing it. Let me drop. 30 gigawatts capacity for Gujarat province and 25 gigawatts capacity for Rajasthan province, and that is all from wind and solar. So it's probably one of the biggest plants in the world. I was reading a little bit more about it, and that came from not really India trying to be clean or clean energy, clean country. It was a big push from European Union, and India started to lose money. And they had to do something to please Europeans. India, among China and a few others, are the biggest pollutants in the world. And I believe it's sort of cosmetic action. The government has zeroed in barren desert areas, avoiding using agricultural land, and in sunny and windy regions, ideal to renewable energy facilities. But what really amazed me was 18 months building facility period. It's amazing. Okay, so well, at least we're entering to something from that region. China is not willing to do it all. But anyhow, what is your comments? And I'm going to go to the third point.
Well, you know, A for effort. As you pointed out, I think it's more of a public relations thing. The government seems to be the only one interested in doing this business, which would be a very important thing. Doesn't quite seem to be terribly interested. Degree China is sort of pulling the same nonsense, where they're showing plans to do all kinds of carbon-cutting measures without any significant cutting of carbon footprint. So, you know, they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. So, I don't know. It depends on how optimistic people are that they'll follow through with their investments. I mean, things could be worse, I guess. They could say that there's no problem and not do anything about it. But, you know, a little bit, you know, I wish they would be a little bit more into doing it, especially in the business sector.
Okay, Chinese are ready to share some collected moon samples, but that would not be discussed for me. I'm just mentioning it. Number four. The ugliest orchid in the world discovered. And it is indeed, if you look at the links, Dr. Roy It is ugly. Absolutely amazingly ugly, Mr. Johnson. British researchers have discovered 156 new plants of fungi in 2020, including the brown flesh and whatsoever, but the ugliest orchid in the world was discovered in Madagascar this year, has recently been significantly described, so orchids are considered to be particularly beautiful and noble plants, but that doesn't apply to everyone. The Royal Botanical Gardens in Great Britain have now introduced the ugliest orchid in the world, and that is in Great Britain Botanical Garden. The orchid is brown with 11 millimeters, rather smaller, and also quite ugly. After fertilization, the fruit hung higher above the forest floor and can better distribute the dust like seeds. I hope you open up the link and you could describe it better, and to Xia.
Well, I mean, the problem is that it's not the greatest picture. It's one single shot, and it doesn't give you a sense of three-dimensional characteristics. I mean, if you like Aliens, the movie, you might like this. It looks like it has some white things at the top, which could be mistaken for teeth. It has a little bit of foliage over it, which could be lips. And so, you know, it could be the center snout of the alien in both Alien and Alien movies. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
And here's something from your work, Dr. Royt. Doctor finally constructed a Kirky of healthy, low-carbonate diet. There is a difference between healthy food and slim-looking like. But for those who want to get a little bit less in their natural fat, that might not be really very much helpful. But in everybody's life, the most important is life. The doctor actually made those study on 15,000 people over 25 years, and they were taking care of every group of the people in their study, and they give low-carb dieters two pieces of information to chew on, and the authors of collaborative team from Brigham and Women's Hospital at Massachusetts Harvard and Harvard Medical School came to the conclusion, and they finally constructed the healthy food for the length of the life. That means the way that they were trying to put it on. Put it on the table for people to read is how to eat to live longer. Dr. Roy.
Well, yeah, you're alluding to a study that was published in Lancet recently. It takes over 15,000 people, as you mentioned, over 25 years, and to discuss the healthiest low carbohydrate diet. So people who have been put on either Atkins diets or Atkins-like diets by their cardiologists have something to evaluate and see if things could be improved. Hierarchy studies with food has a mixed history. The agricultural sector has kind of gotten their mitts on federal guidelines. And if you ever want a good laugh, look at the food pyramid through the ages from the US FDA. And it's rather amusing to see the necessity of foods that really shouldn't be necessities. So it's an interesting study. I hope it benefits people. And I put links to all these articles, by the way, on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com.
Thank you for that. Doctor, finally, Stanford, path planning algorithm enables autonomous multi-drone aerial surveys of Antarctic penguin colonies. The area of the study was having about 300,000 of penguins in pairs, so that would be 600,000 penguins. That was done by Stanford University researcher Mac Schwager. The guy is a young guy. Shortly after his PhD, he went to wedding with and decided to go with his sister-in-law to in 2016 to the areas of heavy populations of penguins, and that's how the thing started. So apparently, what they do is they have a number of drones and they have a landing pad, and before that, there was a guy actually hanging out of the window from the helicopter. The helicopter was very noisy and was disturbing penguins. Since drones are approximately the size of the large bird and the penguins don't have too many predators, flying predators in their environment, they ignore them. So scientists were trying to put the landing pads for those drones, and the landing pad is a charging station also. The drone is flying and then taking the pictures. They have a control over the colony and it's coming back and charging and doesn't require too much attention. But they find out that with the battery life of 15-20 minutes in that cold temperature, they can fly only about 8 months during a year. So then Mac Schwager decided he got into the brilliant idea to have a fleet of drones. Each one has its own path, and that's based on algorithms. And those autonomous multi-drone fleets could survey in much shorter time, make the pictures, and send them to the base, come to the charging station, and they could be simply unattended. So that's interesting what is happening right now. Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good. Drones are very useful devices. They use all the time for television and movies, and we have more than one amateur radio operator in the club who's fascinated by them and owns some and has some YouTube videos of them flying them. And computer algorithms are always getting better over time. So, you know, it's a good story, and I hope we learn more about our feathered friends. I used to visit penguins at the Coney Island Aquarium when I was younger, and it was fun to watch them.
The Mayflower, the famous Mayflower is back. Okay. Some of the history in September 1620, a merchant ship called Mayflower set sail from Plymouth, a port on the southern coast of England, and normally the flower cargo was wine and dry goods, but on this trip the ship carried passengers, 102 of them, hoping to start new life on other side of Atlantic. Nearly 40 of the passengers were Protestant separatists or whoever. But it doesn't matter. It's not important. The importance is that this started what we know right now, the United States of America.